Give me your Bibles, if you would, to Matthew, the 13th chapter. While you're turning there, we'd say again, thank you, Victory Baptist Church and Brother Justice, for inviting us to the conference, for putting on this conference for now, I believe he said, 31 years. It's a great effort. We pray God would reward you richly. Matthew 13, we'll begin reading at verse 24. Another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, there appeared the tares also. So the servants of the householder came and said unto him, Sir, didst not thou sow good seed in thy field? From whence then hath it tares? He said unto them, An enemy hath done this. The servants said unto him, Wilt thou then that we go and gather them up? But he said, Nay, lest while ye gather up the tares, ye root up also the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and in the time of harvest I will say to the reapers, Gather ye together first the tares, and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. Appreciate the message by Brother Chamberlain on the definition of what is hyper-Calvinism. We'd like to borrow one statement that he said. He said, the definition, like many things, are hard to nail down. It's like jello to the wall. Well, so is the history of many things, because what history is there that we have a complete history on? So I hope you don't expect me to cover everything from A to Z on this, because I believe that would be an impossible task. We focused our attention on the major history of hyper-Calvinism among Baptists. And as I studied this, I realized and found out that the history of hyper-Calvinism is relatively young. It is really not that old. Its main origin or beginning can be traced no later than the late 18th century or early 19th century. Now, this doesn't mean that there wasn't any type or form of hyper-Calvinism that existed prior to that. There are evidence of some of the beliefs and characteristics, the definitions that Brother Chamberlain gave before the time I'm talking about. But here is where we find most of the history, so that's the part I'm going to deal with. However, it is interesting to note that the history of hyper-Calvinism or hard-shellism, which I may refer to in this message, I'm more familiar with that term than hyper-Calvinism. There was a time I didn't know what hyper-Calvinism meant, but I knew what hard-shellism was, and then I found out they're both the same thing. But anyway, the history of hyper-Calvinism is found in another history, and that's the history of the foreign missions movement. So we're going to have to look at both of those histories a little bit, because the latter that we're looking at rests upon the former. Upon considering how young the history of hyper-Calvinism is, I immediately wondered why these errors waited so late to show up, or why there weren't more of them earlier in previous centuries. And again, there's evidence to support that some of these things and beliefs that exist today did exist, but again, it has evolved like most errors has. So therefore, again, difficult to pin down in some places in human history. But the main significance or evidence is in that early 19th century. As, again, I thought on the young history, I thought, why is this so again when error is as old as truth is? You know, it's as ancient as truth is. We look at Genesis chapter 3 and see that very thing. And the text I read I chose because it reminds me that as long as there have been true disciples of Christ, there have been false disciples. And as long as there has been truth, there's always going to be falsehood, errors, and heresies among the truths. To divert or pervert or to disguise or to hide the truth. So while there have always been errors, heresies, and falsehood, it occurred to me there have not always been the same errors and falsehoods in existence at the same time. In fact, as I considered this, became very evident that they come and they go and they revive and they go into remission. And we've seen those things even in our lifetime. And Satan is very good at that. But again, they appear and disappear and almost remind you like trying to buy McRibs at McDonald's. You don't know if it's going to be there or not. You know, they come and go. But one thing for sure is truth remains constant. You know, it is that constant thing that is always there, but error is always adapting to the times and changing with the seasons to meet or pervert what truth there is. Consider just a little bit about the evolution of error as I begin here. Even our Lord's own personal ministry, when He was here upon the earth, look at the form or the types of errors and heresies that He was confronted with, for the most part, from the Pharisees and Sadducees. And I'm not going to enumerate them, but you know what He was faced with. And then consider that as He left this earth and left His church here to do His work, and we read through the book of Acts, look at the heresies and errors that continued, like I read in the text, to just sprout up, one right after the other. The people of God and the churches of God wouldn't no more deal with one till there was another new one. It's almost like fighting fire out west. You know, you get it put out in one place, and lo and behold, you find out it started somewhere else. And so this is the way error does. And a close look, of course, at the epistles of the New Testament, you realize this is what the writers are dealing with constantly. Most of it's instructions on dealing with this heresy, this error, correcting here or rebuking there. So, kind of reminds us of the difficult task we have in identifying and trying to cull out or define what error is. As we consider error and its evolution, we realize that even in the early churches, that error continued to multiply and divide those early churches over doctrinal things until eventually it evolved and culminated in what we know as the mother of most false doctrines, and that's the Catholic Church. Now, down through the Dark Ages, the major opposition to the Lord's churches and truth were the teachings of the Catholic Church, weren't they? There were still, of course, the ever-present superstitious beliefs of paganism and idolatry, which had always been there and will always be there. But again, these were still minor in number and magnitude, considering what was being compared to what's coming out of Rome and those evolving heresies which kept coming. And then we had the advent of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. And with that, we have a whole new brood of errors, heresies, and false teachings that are hatched out to attack the truth. This revival of religion that so many champion as the Protestant Reformation coming out of Catholicism really, under careful scrutiny, only altered the flavor of many of the existing or pre-existing errors. As these events and things begin to happen in religion, also things happening in human history, a new seedbed was being prepared for more and more heresies and falsehoods to sprout up. And just in the brief history I've presented to you here, you see that wherever the truth has went, wherever it has made advancements, opposition to it in the form of error and heresy was not far behind, and in many places, right along beside of it. Now consider a little bit more history at this point in human history. Contributing to all of this happening with the Protestant Reformation, etc., we had the exploration and colonization of many of the European countries, discovering new worlds and new continents. Civilization was advancing on a global scale. World populations were increasing. People were traveling more now by ship to new continents and what have you. And we know from American history that the peoples who came to this country, to America, came with a desire not to be persecuted religiously, and number two, to evangelize the people that they found already living here. So evangelism was on their minds as well as fleeing from persecution. As this country grew, new continents were found and civilizations expanded again, we see that people being able to travel from continent to continent now begin to feel, Christians did, the burden of evangelizing peoples that before they didn't even know existed. Exactly what Romans teaches us, our debt to the world in that respect. And so what we would call a foreign missions or missionary movement began in scope and scale in the late 18th century, early 19th century, that really was impossible, humanly speaking, beforehand. This began to happen in predominantly England and America, and this debt and duty to the Great Commission began to manifest itself in various ways. One of the first, and there's lots of things I could mention, but I'm going to try to be brief and just mention a few of the major things in a chronological order. There was a Baptist Mission Society that was organized in England in 1792, and this organization came into being by the strong pursuit, influence, and urging of a man named William Carey. He then was sent out, of course, as many of you know, and you've had messages preached on this man or his work in this very conference a few years ago. He was sent out as the first missionary of that organization to India the following year in 1793. So foreign missions were getting going. This missionary zeal was taking place. As the news of these things happening in England reached America, the enthusiasm and zeal for foreign missions increased here among Baptists in this country. Now knowing that the heathen of foreign lands that we didn't know even existed at the time could now be reached. And so the fervor was increased in America at that time. The Baptists in this country had already, in a localized sense, banded together in fellowships or evangelistic efforts as they could, but they had experienced difficulty in doing that on any level to any degree. And that's for several reasons. As far as a district organization or a state convention, as we would know it today, those things were difficult then and there for several reasons. Briefly, let me mention them. Number one was the autonomy of the local church that people believed in so strongly back then, but also the difficulty of travel and communication really hindered and prevented those things from taking place to a great degree. But now with this news from England and of what was able to happen by ship and missionaries actually going forth from the society that I aforementioned in England, they now sought with a greater zeal to unite in associations or societies, unions, that together they could do what they could not do singularly. And that was advance foreign missions with a cooperative effort. But there was still the difficulty of trying to do anything on a national level because of the aforementioned problems. John T. Christian, in his book, A History of the Baptist, which many of you probably have, gives a good quote of the state of Baptists in America at this time and the challenges that they were facing in wanting to do something, but what the sacrifice was going to take to get it done. He says this, "As yet the Baptists of the United States had not organized any general meeting. There were great hindrances in the way of such a gathering. Distances were great. Much of the country was sparsely settled. The roads were often impassable. The modes of travel were slow and often dangerous. And as yet there was no commanding motive for such a body. However, the conversion of Judson furnished the motive. The opening of a mission in Burma, the inspiration. Under these conditions, the General Convention of the Baptist denomination in the United States, generally known as the Triennial Convention, was organized." Now, Adoniram Judson was mentioned in that quote by Brother Christian. And indeed, this man did play a major role of the foreign mission movements in America, because Judson was sent out by an organization in 1811 called the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. And this organization was not a Baptist organization. It was formed by the leaders of the Congregationalists. And they had urged, however, other denominations to embrace it and to help them support the foreign missions. Some of the Baptists were warmly embracing it when Judson set off. But if you're familiar with his journey, you know something miraculous sort of happened on that journey. He and those other missionaries went forth, and on the ship he began to study Baptist doctrine because he knew he was going to be confronted with it when he landed. And lo and behold, like so many who have done so in studying the truth, he became converted by it. So he became a Baptist while he was on the waters, and that presented quite a problem, because now he was not one of those who had sent him. So this meant now that Baptists were going to have a missionary that they hadn't sent out and couldn't support. But again, God's providence was sufficient to the task. And we see that a man who was with him, Luther Rice, also converted to the Baptist faith on that journey, while the others did not. He left Judson and his wife, Anne, and he returned to America to seek to gain support for him. And his efforts resulted in the formation of what we know of that Brother Christian referenced there, the first Baptist convention or organization on any national level, and it's a long name, the General Missionary Convention of the Baptist Denomination in the United States. Organized in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 1814, but it was shortened and called the Triennial Convention because it was to convene only once every 3 years. Out of this convention came what we know of now as the Baptist Foreign Mission Board. All right? So that's an important part of history if you want to be up on the history of these things. The history of the missions movement to this point is really the foundation that brings us to the history of what we know today as hyper-Calvinism. Because contemporaneous, that's a big word, isn't it? But very meaningful. Contemporaneous, meaning right along with it, as we said, with this foreign mission movement and zeal and organization and all this, is where we find hyper-Calvinism or hard-shellism really manifesting itself to a great degree among Baptists. In fact, it's right there with it. You can't look at the one without seeing the other. It kind of reminds me of a railroad track, you know, two rails side by side. Wherever that one goes, the other one's going to be right there with it. So wherever this zeal seemed to go, opposition seemed to begin to rise up against it. It was just that cause and effect oriented. And when this zeal went forth and unions and societies and seminaries, colleges to train preachers, all this was going on, this opposition rose up, and it was called by a lot of names, all kinds of names, but it was anti-everything is what it amounted to. It was either anti-missions, it's called anti-effort, anti-means, hard-shellism, all kinds of names. Many others I'm not even going to bother to mention. But there was a very aggressive campaign and opposition against this mission movement, the organization or establishment of seminaries, tract societies, temperance societies, other things that were being advanced by the missionary-minded Baptists. The criticism of these opponents as they began to rise up was simply this, that these organizations were extra-congregational organizations, meaning they were outside of the local church, and therefore they were to be opposed. They were missionary unscriptural societies, some of them labeled. Others labeled them with a label that kind of stands out, New Innovations, they called them. And one predominant leader of this movement, a man named John Taylor, actually went so far as to call some of these congregational societies the Baptist Papacy. So they were very fervent and aggressive in their opposition. It appears that this opposition began predominantly in the South and West, but it was not limited to there geographically. It also spread to the north and to the northeastern states. I'll mention some names of some of the early leaders. Probably you may have heard of some of them, and the rest of them may be anonymous to most of you. But some of the early leaders that are included in history as being founding fathers are a man named Joshua Lawrence, a man named John Leland. Daniel Parker's probably the name that most of you might recognize with this. Samuel Trott, John Taylor, as I aforementioned. Thomas P. Dudley, Wilson Thompson, James Osborne, Dr. John Watson, Gilbert Beebe, maybe another familiar name, John Clark, Stephen Gard, C.B. Hassell, Richard Newport, Joel Hume. These are the predominant names that seem to show up in history. But those in this movement regarded themselves and actually seemingly were very proud to take the title of being primitive Baptists. And they meant that with meaning to distinguish themselves that they and they alone were holding to the original and historic teachings, doctrines, and practices of Baptists. So that's why they like that name and adhere to that name, and we even still have primitive Baptist churches today. And I think probably if those brethren were to speak for themselves, they'd say that's still why they like to be primitive, you know, but for that very reason. But they attempted to retain or restore the primitive, original patterns that they believed to be in the Baptist churches of history. And some of these, we even went so far as unsalaried ministers, a cappella singing, no music in the church, even some foot worship. So again, that shows the variety of things that exist, you know, just like Baptists. There are variations. Just because they're hyper-Calvinists doesn't mean they all believe everything the same. There are many splinters and variations. It appears that this is something I found very interesting. It appears that the original opposition by those of the anti-missions movement was not based on doctrine or theology primarily, but on methodology. Now, then we're talking about initially, okay? And I'm not saying there wasn't any of them that didn't oppose it for what we would know of today, hyper-Calvinist doctrine. All right? But actually, the history I have found, most of that came later. It evolved into that. So the main opposition appears to be methodology. And these original, many of these original hard-shell forefathers, the late 1700s, early 1800s, were not objecting to the missions movement that was sweeping the Baptists for doctrinal reasons, not because they believed in the Spirit alone regeneration theory or pre-faith generation or time-lapse salvation, as Brother Chamberlain mentioned. That seemed to develop later. And I'll explain to you, I think, why. It's pretty simple, really. But that would be an idea that would justify the movement or become more predominant later. Really, what some have said is second generation of hard shells or hyper-Calvinists. But again, Brother Justice handed out a little book by Bob Ross. He wrote some other stuff on hard shellism. He wrote a book called History and Heresies of Hard Shellism. And in that, this is the same thing he says, that most of this started due to an objection to the mission methodology. He quotes in that book, the original issue in the anti-mission movement was methodology, not theology. If Baptist histories can be relied upon, the original issues in the anti-mission schism focused upon mission methodology. The Kahuki Declaration set forth by Kahuki Association, North Carolina, October 1827, objected to, quote, the modern missionary movement and other institutions of men, unquote. And it specified within that, quote, missionary societies, Bible societies, tract societies, Sunday schools, Dorcas societies, Mite societies, religious fairs and festivals, temperance societies, sectarian schools, and theological seminaries, unquote, as the objects of their repudiation. Further in that book, one more quote, Brother Ross writes this, in the Potter Throgmorton debate, which was in Fulton, Kentucky, 1887, so many years later than what I've been talking to now, 60 years later than when most of this has been going on. In that debate, Elder Lemuel Potter of the Primitive Baptists insisted upon the fact that it was over the missionary methods, such as boards, Sunday schools, etc., that the split occurred in the year 1832 between the anti-missionaries and the missionaries. Here's what he said, quote, I wish to notice some things in the speech we have just listened to. The first thing Mr. Throgmorton does is to say that he is not bound to show that the Baptists had Sunday schools, missionary boards, etc. during all the ages. He is under no obligation to show that they always had them. He admits that. He's begging the question. I challenge him to tell what divided us except these very things. It was after the introduction of these things among us that we divided. If we had never had them, we would have not been divided yet. And that's from the Potter Throgmorton debate, published in 1888. So this is some 60, 70 years after the history we're talking about, where this elder is saying, this is what divided us. Now, a lot of other things had cropped up in those 60 years. Many worse heresies, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but there again, that's the initial thing. But again, remember what we said in the beginning. Heresy doesn't always manifest itself in its full form when it shows up. It can show up in one way, and that's just like if you have the Mormons or the Jehovah's Witnesses come, they're going to present you a Christ of some form, but they're not going to tell everything, are they? No, they're just going to give you a little peek and a little flavor and a little taste, you know, to get you interested. While they're hiding the rest of it. So, error always employs that deceptive tactic. John Taylor, who I mentioned of Kentucky, was a very leading figure in this movement, and some have even credited him as being the founder or co-founder of the what was called the Primitives or Hard Shell group. However, it's Daniel Parker and Joshua Lawrence who usually get the credit and are referred to as the co-founders or founders of this movement. In fact, an opponent of theirs of that day, a man by the name of J.M. Peck, who wrote this in the Baptist Banner and Western Pioneer in July the 4th, 1839. He said, Daniel Parker in the West and Joshua Lawrence in the East are in truth and fairness the fathers and founders of this sect. These two worthies, one in Texas, the other in North Carolina, are the two heads of the party. Mr. Peck knew these men well. At least he knew Parker very well, because he debated him twice in Indiana, once in 1822, once in 1825, over the very issue of missions. And both times it was unanimous in favor of missions, and Parker suffered a defeat both times. But it certainly didn't hinder his spirit to keep speaking out against it. Mr. Parker didn't stay in one place. He traveled over the United States and was very effective in persuading people to oppose the mission movement. He was very vocal, very loud, in both writing and word. His influence and aggression and condemnation of missions extended from North Carolina through Tennessee, Kentucky, Illinois, and eventually from Indiana to Texas. And everywhere he went, if you study this, you just see a trail of division, and kind of like where a tornado or something went through churches, because he was that effective in his aggression against missions. So division, opposition, confusion, and at the same time, not only was he anti-missions movement, but he had some personal doctrines that he sought to sow seeds. In fact, it was called the two seeds or two seedism. Again, no surprise here. One heresy begets other heresies. If you endorse or embrace one heresy, you're leaving the door wide open to embrace something similar or worse. And so let that be a lesson to all of us. We're not immune, and that's the way it works. Some say that Daniel Parker very possibly believed, or may have been one of the original proponents of what we know of today as the Spirit alone regeneration doctrine. But I found in what he read and what he's written, that's simply not the case. From what I have read of him saying and in his addresses, it seems very clear that he believed in the means of the gospel and the salvation of the elect. But nevertheless, he did a lot of damage. Another key leader who was very aggressive opponent of the mission movements among Baptists at that time was a man that Brother Chamberlain mentioned in his restoration movement, and that was Alexander Campbell. A very eloquent man, speaker, and writer. And I have read where the Baptists, in looking for somebody to voice their cause on this anti-mission movement, readily embraced him. Of course, he was among the Baptists from about 1813 to 1830. And they readily put their arms around him because he was such a strong voice against the missions movement and some of the four things mentioned: a cappella singing, no music, unsalaried ministers, and things of that nature. So he was involved in this movement to a great degree. And he published a couple of magazines that he wrote very strong against the anti-missions movement. And he eventually, of course, not only was a voice in that, but with his heresy of baptismal regeneration and other things, he caused kind of a splits within splits on that. And eventually came out of that what we know of today, of course, as the Churches of Christ or the Campbellite denomination. Some looking at this history would even say, and I couldn't deny it myself, that with this anti-mission spirit and fervor, there were really two false doctrines that came out of that, twin false doctrines, Hardshellism and Campbellism. He was a leading voice and proponent, of course, of both. But after about 30 years of this ongoing conflict concerning missions and the methodology and what have you, the contention, strife, splits, divisions, church members leaving, forming new churches and such things like this, all that had come together to start with was very severely weakened among Baptists in America. The differences were very deep, and it was beginning to be felt, until the point that it's hard to really put a finger on it and say, okay, this is where it happened or divided. One reason that's difficult to do is because, again, you consider the lack of communication, the distance and differences of the churches, and then again the autonomous nature, strong belief of the churches. However, there is something that did happen in the year 1832 that pretty well marks historically the division that took place between what we know of as hyper-Calvinists or hard shells and missionary Baptists. And it's a address or a meeting that convened that was called the Black Rock Address. This was organized by one of the founders that I mentioned a while ago, or the leading, one of the leaders. His name was Gilbert Beebe. And this meeting was held at the Black Rock Meeting House in Baltimore, Maryland, September 1832. The records of this meeting show that, again, the focus of these meetings was on the methods initially that were being used in missions, and not on the particular doctrine of regeneration, which later would become the identifying characteristic. All the references to regeneration or the new birth from the records of this meeting, in fact, in backing up to the one I mentioned before in 1827, the Kahookie Declaration in Kentucky, the Black Rock Address also, both of them set forth consistently the Baptist position that's been held by even all of us in the London Confession of Faith, that the effectual calling was by His Word and by His Spirit. Let me give you a quote from this Black Rock Address. "The plans of these protracted or revival meetings are equally as objectionable," and they're talking about the missionary Baptists. "For in the first place, all doctrinal preaching," in other words, all illustrations of God's plan of salvation, "are excluded from these meetings. Hence, they would make believers of their converts without presenting any fixed truths to their minds to believe. Whereas God has chosen His people to salvation through sanctification of the Spirit and belief of the truth," quoted from 2 Thessalonians 2:13. And that's in a Black Rock Address, page 3536 of Primitive Publications. So again, it's rather startling to see that again, methodology began to be where the separation and the definition and the ideology began. However, the means to which the original opponents of the missionary Baptist objected was, again, not the gospel itself as such, but the methods which were being devised and used in the missionary effort of the gospel. The means of the missionary efforts were not the problem, but the method of presenting the means. And I don't say that to be confusing, but I hope you understand that. The objectors didn't focus their opposition upon the gospel as a means, as the London Confession of Faith stated, but again, upon the methods being used. However, it was not long as time passed till the one gave way to the other. And this is very logical if you consider it. As time passed, the divisions between the missionaries and the primitives, the distinctions became not one so much of the methodology of the means, but of a theological difference regarding the means of the gospel and regeneration. And again, it's very easy to see how this would happen. Just consider it. If you initially oppose the method of means, why not just oppose the means altogether? And then you kill two birds with one stone. And that's what happened, it appears. So methodology gave way to theologically difference. And then we have what we commonly recognize today, these beliefs among the hard shells, hyper-Calvinists, that are labeled spirit alone, generation, regeneration, pre-faith regeneration, as Brother Chamberlain so adequately defined these for us, time salvation, which would tell us there are regenerated unbelievers walking around in places, time-lapse salvation, and then other things added in there too of different flavors. So just consider that there have been divisions and splinters within what I have described to you as the history of hyper-Calvinism. They don't all believe the same alike. They adopt some things and leave other things and change to other things, but I've not tried to cover all that, obviously, for time and space, and couldn't do it anyway. But I've only tried to present the most important points of their young history and to remind us all that wherever truth is, error's going to be there, and this is just one form of it. May God give us the grace to always identify error.